Belgic Confession, Article 37, The Last Judgment. The first paragraph reads as follows. Finally, we believe, according to the Word of God, when the time appointed by the Lord, which is unknown to all creatures, is come, and the number of the elect complete, that our Lord Jesus Christ will come from heaven, corporally and visibly, as he ascended, with great glory and majesty, to declare himself judge of the quick and the dead, burning this old world with fire and flame to cleanse it. Tonight we have our seventh and final class on the 70 weeks of Daniel 9. These seven classes can be broken down as follows. The first four dealt especially with dispensationalism, explaining and critiquing their position, and it was what we might call more negative and more difficult. And then the last three classes were looking at the reformed or non-dispensationalist position, because what we're saying is pretty much what everybody holds unless you're a dispensationalist. It's more positive, which we like, and it's easier, which we're tempted to say we really like. We've had four C's so far. Can anyone tell me what the four C's are? Letter C. The four C's. In order, Christ, the cross, the covenant, and chronology. So we've been giving a positive presentation of the teaching of these four verses. Christ, that answers the question, who? Who is this passage especially dealing with? And then the cross and the covenant, that answers the question, what? What does this Christ do? And then, see if we can come up with another quid. When? Chronology, that's the when question. Now, a little bit more on chronology before we head on. Not a lot, though. I thought about getting into more chronology and names and numbers in other places, but I decided against it. We said regarding the chronology, the seven sevens, that it is a symbolic number, not only because it doesn't fit literally, as we saw especially last week. The 70 sevens is a symbolic number. First, because the number of the covenant, 7, times the number of fulfillment, 10. 7 tens is 70. And second, because this is a vision. Consider the vision, verse 23 ends. 70 weeks. And vision is biblical language for something that's going to deal with symbolism, like the book of Revelation, which also has a lot of symbolic sevens. But besides the points I just made, repeating points from last week, I'd like to add this now from Matthew 18. So please turn with me to Matthew 18, verses 21 through 28. Matthew 18, verse 21. Matthew 18, verse 21. Then came Peter to him and said, Lord, how oft shall my brother sin against me, and I forgive him? Till seven times? Jesus saith unto him, I say not unto thee until seven times, but until 70 times seven. Now here we have numbers, 7, 70, 70 times seven, like Daniel 9. It's not literal. Jesus isn't literally saying that if someone wrongs you, you can forgive him time number 489 and 490, but after that, you know, that's you're finished with him. No matter how badly, how earnestly he repents. It's not literal, like Daniel 9. And both passages, Matthew 18 and Daniel 9, are both dealing with the forgiveness of sins. Daniel 9, verse 24. speaking of the work of the Messiah, the prince who's going to be cut off and have nothing, he will thereby finish the transgression, make an end of sins, make reconciliation for iniquity, and bring in everlasting righteousness. Now, the remaining material in this class, and therefore this series, we have three more subjects which we will cover tonight, and we're going to stay here until we're all finished. Don't worry, it won't be late. There are actually three more C's, and it's not forced, although you can judge for yourself at the end. He's just trying to get C's, and he's trying to make it work. And so when I was telling Mary about this, she said, well, you're going to talk about seven seas. Well, are you going to sail the seven seas tonight? Well, we would only be sailing the fifth, sixth, and seventh seas anyway. But no, it's not that sort of seas. The seven seas, S-E-A-S, bodies of water. And so I looked it up. There was the ancient Roman seven seas, which were seven navigable mouths of the Po River, close to Venice. The medieval Arabs also spoke about seven seas. The seven seas you would take if you were sailing from Arabia down the Persian Gulf and into China. And nowadays, the seven seas are seven oceans, just in case you were wondering. The Atlantic, north and south. The Pacific, north and south. The Indian, and then the Arctic and the Antarctic. So there you are. But we're not actually talking about the seven seas in any form, contemporary, medieval, Arabic, or ancient Roman. The fifth sea also is answering the when question and flows from the chronology. The fifth sea is coming. Coming. And here the issue is, does Daniel 9 deal with the first coming of Christ or the second coming? What does a dispensationalist say to that question? The second coming. What verses would he point to in support, verses interpreted in his framework, but verses he would point to in support of that position of the handout? The handout is the diagram of Daniel 9, 24 through 27, which is also on our website. Just scroll down a bit and hit notes. That'll pop up. So what verses would a dispensationalist point to saying, this is dealing with the future, the end of the world, and events and connected with the second coming of Christ, whether it's their first second coming or their second coming or their third second coming? What verses would they point to?
27.
They'd point to verse 27, which they see is referring to the Antichrist and his work. And they'd point to another verse. Now, if 27 is one of them and 26 isn't one of them, you're down to a 50-50. What verse then? 24, yes. Because 24... the dispensationalists take the six great works of God to refer not to the cross, but to the millennium. The millennium, transgressions finished, end of sins, reconciliation and equity, everlasting righteousness, sealed up the vision of prophecy, and so on. But you think, the millennium, people are still going to be old natures, a whole lot of unbelievers. At the end, the church is going to be one city with Gog and Magog, the vast majority of the world population, attacking them. So it doesn't look like that to me anyway, but that's the point. What about for us? First or second coming? Daniel 9?
First coming,
and it's not just us, it's practically all non-dispensationalists say, this passage isn't about the end times future to us. It's about the first coming of Christ. Which verses do we appeal to for this position?
24,
yes.
25,
yes.
26,
yes. 27, yes. In fact, we believe how much do verses 24, 25, 26, and 27, how much do they say about the second coming of Christ and things future to us? Nothing. And this, of course, fits with the previous four C's, The passage is about Christ. And what about Christ? He's dealing with his cross and is confirming the covenant. The chronology runs from Cyrus all the way up to the birth of Christ, the cross when he was cut off and had nothing, and then goes to AD 70. So it's dealing with his first coming. The first coming itself, his birth and cross and what the cross achieved in terms of those six things. What follows upon the cross, this causing sacrifice and oblation to cease. And then AD 70 is a judgment upon the church, the Old Testament Jewish church, for rejecting its Messiah. Huh. Now, here we're going to bring in another subject, which we've covered in our eschatology classes on Belgic Confession, Article 37. What was the last subject we looked at in these Wednesday night classes before Daniel 9? The last subject we looked at the end of last season. Mary? Ezekiel 40 through 48 in eschatology. And here we're dredging into deep parts of people's memories here. Ezekiel 40 through 48 is eschatologically significant, especially for whom? Dispensationalists, yes. And this is a second eschatological school. Ezekiel 40 through 48 is significant for the dispensationalists and the historic premillennialists. And they say, well, Ezekiel 40 through 48 awaits fulfillment in a literal 1,000 years in the future. And then we say that the reality of which Ezekiel 40 through 48 speaks is the new heavens and the new earth, the eternal state in the new heavens and the new earth. And we said that there are many different reasons why it is not literal. And when Revelation 21 and 22 picks up these themes, it's telling you, and Revelation 21 and 22 is the longest treatment in the Bible of the new heavens and new earth. It's telling you, this is what Ezekiel is talking about. Here's this motif, this image, this phrase, this idea, and it's in the new heavens and the new earth. Now, here's our parallel. That's Ezekiel 40 through 48, the last subject before Daniel 9. Now, Daniel 9, 24 through 27. It is eschatologically significant for what group? The dispensationalists. The dispensations now, but not the historic premillennialists. And they see Daniel 9 fulfilled when? They see it fulfilled in the great millennium. That's verse 24. What else? The great tribulation. They say verse 27 is about the great tribulation. And their exegesis, although the passage says nothing about it at all, there's not even anything to hang it upon. But they also work under this, not only the great millennium preceded by the great tribulation, but they also fit into their interpretation of this passage, the great parenthesis. Yes. Now, out of those three things, they call them great, and we'd say, well, they're not so great. But anyway, they don't exist even. But of these three things, the great parenthesis, the last 2,000 years and counting, the great tribulation, literal 7-year tribulation, and the great millennium, this passage in Daniel 9, they especially, out of these three, say, this passage refers to the great parenthesis, the great tribulation, and the great millennium. They especially say that this passage deals with, out of those three, the great tribulation. And we say, and this is why I'm paralleling it with Ezekiel 40 through 48, we say, you're putting this in the wrong place, putting this in the wrong period. The reality is that Daniel 9, 24 through 27 deals with the past from our perspective in 2022. The past, not the future. We're looking over our left shoulder backward at this passage. We're not looking over our right shoulder forward. That is, this passage deals with the first coming, not the second coming at all. And then you've got this great parenthesis, which doesn't exist, the great tribulation, literal 7 year, with Antichrist and so forth, with special treaties with the Jews and reneging upon them halfway through, which doesn't exist either. The great millennium doesn't exist as a future period. And you see here, again, the significance of our classes on eschatology and time, right at the start of our study of the last things. We dealt with the two ages, the last days, the 1,000 years, Revelation 20, the 1,260 days, Revelation 11 through 13. And this gives you, and remember now, eschatology is the study of the last things, which includes events and personages, but also time periods. So once you've got that straight, then the issue is, where do you fit eschatological passages, especially eschatologically controversial passages? And you come to the last 9 chapters of Ezekiel, and you don't put them in the millennium, which doesn't exist, but that's not what the passage was teaching anyway. You put them in the eternal state of the new heavens and the new earth. You put them actually sort of further on. They're beyond the millennium, though the millennium doesn't actually exist. The way they interpret is a literal Jewish 1,000 years. And then you move Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel. You move from the last 9 chapters of Ezekiel to the last 4 verses of Daniel 9. And you say, that's not dealing with the great tribulation, literal 7 years. That's dealing actually over the left shoulder. The first coming, you have to go back in time. So Ezekiel's passage, they put it in the wrong period. The period doesn't exist. But it has to go further forward. And then this period, they're putting it in front of us, Daniel 9. And then they should be putting it firmly behind us. Oh dear. Everybody with me so far? All that backwards, forwards, passage, periods, there, we got that straight. Then we're ready to move to our sixth C, our second C of the night. Any guesses?
Completion.
Not bad. The sixth C is council. The sixth C is council. And this answers the question, not who, that's Christ, or what, that's the cross and the covenant, or when, that's chronology and the coming, the first coming. This answers the question,
who?
No, where? Not how, or why, or where. Did I hear where?
I said where.
Where? The answer is, whence. Because whence means, where does it come from? And it all comes from the council. What is the source of all this? Who is the one that Daniel's speaking of? That's Christ. Where does he come from? He comes, of course, he's the eternal Son incarnate, but he comes as part of God's decree. What will he do? When will he do it? All this proceeds from God's eternal counsel, or decree, or plan. We have the handout in front of us. Did anyone pick up on this C? I mean, if I had said to you, it's Christ, you know, you would have said, if I had said, well, there's a C here, there's Christ, you'd immediately have got it, yeah, across the cross. You'd have got that. The covenant, he confirms the covenant, verse 27. The chronology, yeah, of course, there's 70 weeks. Where do they start and begin and so forth? How are they split up? The first coming. But the idea of this passage as speaking of God's counsel, you may well have missed. And you're not going to miss it now. What are the references in this passage to God's eternal counsel?
Determined.
Okay, what verse is that, Mary? 24. 70 weeks are determined. Are there any other references to God's counsel in the passage? This 70 weeks, this vision, it starts with 70 weeks are determined right at the very start. Sovereignty of God over the whole thing.
Same phrase is repeated in verse 26 at the end.
Verse 26. Unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. It's twice.
27.
And it's there in verse 27, and the last line of 26, and the last line of verse 27. And that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Three times in four verses. And it's in the very first line, and it's in the very last line, as well as being partway in the middle. Now, when it speaks of something being determined by whom?
By God.
By God. It's not saying Daniel has determined 70 weeks and he's prognosticating this off his own bat and he's going to see if this happens after he's long dead, or the ungodly, or any man or group of men. It's referring to God, the one Daniel prayed to in the bulk and earlier part of this chapter, and the one who, in answer to that prayer, sent Gabriel to give to Daniel this vision. 70 weeks are determined. Unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. That determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Now, three uses of the word determined in our English version. The word translated determined in verse 24 is a different Hebrew word from that found at the end of verse 26 and the end of verse 27. Those last two cases have the same word. The first word rendered determined is a hapax legomenon. Yep, you probably thought it was one of those, Hilary. It's the only time it's found in the Bible. So we can't really say an awful lot about it, but it does mean determined. But the other word is a bit more interesting, and we know, and the dictionaries say a little bit more about it. It comes from the word to cut, to sharpen, and then to decide and to determine, and to determine strictly, a pointed determination. So this passage is dealing with God, a determination of his mind and will. Strictly determined it. It's a sharp, clear, strict determination or decision of the divine mind and will. Now, God's determination or decree or decision or counsel is like himself. It's wise and holy and just, and it's like himself too, in that it is unchangeable and eternal. And of course, it's for God's glory, and it's for God's glory in Jesus Christ and for the elect church. Now, what does it embrace? According to Daniel 9, 24 through 27, what does God's determination embrace? Verse 24, 70 weeks are determined. So it embraces, God has determined the 70 weeks. Does that involve when the 70 weeks begin and end?
Yes.
Does that involve all the divisions that the 70 weeks consist of? 7 weeks plus 62 weeks plus 1 week, which three sections of weeks are all consecutive. There's no big split between the 69th and the 70th of about 2,000 years and counting. Does this determination regarding the 70 weeks not only include the 70 weeks, where they begin, where they end, and all the divisions, but everything that happens in them that's mentioned here? You know, what's going to happen the first 7 weeks, then there's this gap, and then comes Christ's birth, and then there's the cross, and then there's AD 70. Oh, indeed. So in terms of the previous two classes, and number five today, 70 weeks are determined then includes Christ and his first coming, numbers 1 and 5 there, includes Christ's work on the cross in confirming the covenant. In terms of this symbolic chronology of Daniel 9, it's all determined, strictly, sharply determined. Now, I've been reading some dispensationalist literature on this passage, as you can well believe, for the last 7 weeks. And I never heard anybody emphasize that the way I just did, because 99% of dispensationalists are, they're Arminian. So you just gloss over things like this. But the passage has determined at the very first line, the very last time, three times in four verses, it is emphatic. Now, what of all the things that's included in this divine determination, as in found in Daniel 9, 24 through 27, what is especially emphasized as being in God's counsel or eternal determination? I mentioned all the things in this passage, but the passage itself emphasizes that there's something that's especially, I mean, it's all determined, but it emphasizes one particular thing that's been eternally determined by God. What is that?
Is it in 24, like the finish of transgression and make up the end of sins?
Those things are crucial, those things in verse 24, but they're not the thing, and they are determined, like everything's determined, but they're not the thing in the passage that the passage wants us to note as being specifically determined. Everything's determined, but it picks on us one thing and emphasizes that it's determined. Brian?
It's the coming of Messiah.
Nope.
Is it verse 27?
Yes.
And he shall confirm come.
No. But what's the event? Oh, when it says he shall confirm the covenant, that is one of the things that's determined. But the passage doesn't, like it is determined, but the passage doesn't emphasize that bear in note that all these things are determined. But I want you to especially note that this is determined. Mary?
It's the desolations.
It is, in one short phrase, AD 70. Verse 26. From line 3, the people of the prince that shall come, Titus and his Roman army, the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city, Jerusalem, and the sanctuary, the temple, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. Verse 27 from line 3, for the overspreading of abominations because of these terrible sins, he being Christ throughout this passage, he, and this is even more emphatic, Christ is doing it, and Christ is doing it in accordance with God's decree. Christ is doing it as the sovereign ruler, you understand, the Lord of heaven and earth. He shall make it desolate, even until the consummation. It's all going to be consumed. And that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate. Whew. So the passage, we'll come back to this in a minute, but the passage is saying everything in this in Daniel 9, 24 through 27 is eternally determined by God in his counsel. That's the whence this whole prophecy and all that it prophesies comes. But at the end of verse 26 and the end of verse 27, it says AD 70, the destruction of Jerusalem after the Messiah. It's all determined. We'll come back to that in a minute in our seventh point, Lord willing. So the doctrine taught here by the three uses, as many as that, and including the first line and the last line, the doctrine taught here by these three uses of determined in our four verses is the absolute sovereignty of God, which embraces Christ and his cross and his covenant. All this chronology leading up to and going a bit beyond Christ's first coming, the absolute sovereignty of God over history and prophecy, over good and evil, because there are some things here which the people of God cheer at, and all the things they go, oh, that's going to be terrible, and they shrink from. The absolute sovereignty of God in answer to Daniel's prayer. Now, I mentioned earlier that the dispensationalists don't do anything with this determined in the material which I read anyway. But what aspect, this is a second additional point we're making now, what aspect of the dispensationalist interpretation of Daniel 9, 23 through 27 does God's determination or counsel most oppose? Now the question is not, you know, this sovereign determination of God, what aspect of dispensationalism does it most oppose? Or what aspect of Arminianism, because 99% of dispensationists are Arminians. Although some of them would say I'm at this point Calvinist and so forth, but you know all that. But I'm asking this truth that God has determined all the events and people of Daniel 9, 24 through 27. What aspect of the dispensationalist exegesis of this passage does the determination most oppose? There is an answer. And when you hear the answer, you say, that's a good question. That's a penetrating question. But if you don't get the answer, you'll probably be thinking, I'm still not sure I understand the question. Yeah. So we'll say it one more time. The passage emphasizes God's determining all this. You've heard, and this is your seventh week of it for all of you who've been able to make it through all the bad weather and sickness and so forth. What is the bit of the dispensationalist interpretation of Daniel 9, 24 through 27 that the determination truth most opposes? What's the element in their view? Brian?
That men go about to establish these things without the control of God.
No. And I hope whenever I tell you the answer to the question, you're all going to go, ah, yes, I like that. No, that's a good point. The answer is the great parenthesis, because the great parenthesis is a plan B. It's a plan B. That is, Jesus Christ in his first coming, and they do believe that when it says Messiah the Prince or Messiah will be cut off in 25 or 26, that bit's referring to the first coming. I mean, Messiah the Prince, I mean, what else can you do with that? But then they jump to the second coming, and they're way more interested in that. But they believe that Christ came in order to offer the Jews an earthly Jewish kingdom. And it was a well-meaning offer. He really wanted them to... Shucks, it just didn't happen. But Israel rejected that offer and then were stuck with plan B. And we're all feeling seriously underwhelmed. We're stuck with plan B, which is where we come along. I didn't really get the Christmas present that I wanted, but you know, Mummy gave me this and she said we were short of money. And well, I had to smile and say thanks, but I'm hoping for better next year. The plan B, and this passage starts, the 70 weeks are determined. And they're all consecutive weeks. It's all fixed in the eternal counsel of God. And then verse 26, these desolations are determined. These is verse 27, it's all determined. The 70 weeks, everything in the 7 weeks, where they start, where they end. There's no ambiguity, there's no uncertainty, there's no, but if Israel actually accepts this, then we'll jump straight into a Jewish super kingdom. Determined, it's all fixed. All eternally fixed exactly as it says in this passage. Any comments on that, Brian?
No, it's just saying on the tin.
It does exactly what it says in the tin. Good. Are we ready for our seventh C? Maybe you could say you're with me here, so we're all sailing the seventh C together. The seventh C is?
Consummation.
Comfort. The seventh C is comfort. And this is sort of the application of it all. And the question here that we're answering is, why? Here's Daniel's 7 weeks. Who's the one who's coming? It's the Christ. What's he going to do? Make satisfaction for sins on the cross and bring in everlasting righteousness to confirm the covenant. When's this going to happen? Is this chronology and it's his first coming? This is all whence? It's all coming out of God's eternal counsel. And then why? Why does God tell us this? This is actually for our comfort. It's for the church's sake. Church being people of God, both in the Old Testament and New Testament. Any who would read this passage. Yes, it's for Daniel's comfort, that first of all and most immediately. But all these things are written for our understanding too. So number seven is a sort of application. This is designed to console the people of God. So let's go through the chronology here from the start. The first 7 weeks. What's going to happen in the first 7 weeks? Verse 26, 25. A commandment will go forth to restore and build Jerusalem. And that's good news for Daniel. He's in Mesopotamia at the moment. The commandment is going to go forth, and we're going to restore and build Jerusalem. That's good. Continuing in verse 25 a bit further, the street will be built again, the wall, even in troublous times. We're going to rebuild, and we're going to go back to the promised land, but here's the rub. It will be troublous. Then we have 62 weeks, which is basically the intertestamental period, the silent years. These 7 weeks plus the 62 weeks takes us to Messiah the Prince, which I take to be a reference to his birth. Then the Messiah, verse 26, so the Messiah is going to come, that's good. There's going to be sort of a silent period in which there was no written revelation or prophets. Then he's going to be cut off and have nothing. Then verse 24 says that this Messiah, who's going to be cut off and have nothing, will achieve the redemption of the church and deal with Daniel's sin and the sins of God's people in the Old Testament by finishing, making an end of, and making reconciliation for iniquity, transgression, and sins. That's the sort of the more negative part, dealing with our problem. And then he's going to bring in everlasting righteousness. And in so doing, he will seal up by bringing fulfillment to the Old Testament vision and prophecy, and he will anoint the most holy, because the holy places on earth, and the most holy place especially, speaks of heaven, and Christ then goes into heaven. Verse 27 says, he will confirm the covenant with many 1 week. Here's the confirmation of the covenant. He confirms this covenant because this cup is the New Testament in my blood, which is shed for many, his particular atonement with a particular covenant. And then so there's the good news, and there's the comfort for God's sinful and sin-oppressed people, because Christ didn't come to call the righteous but sinners to repentance, people who know their sins and miseries. And then verse 26, the people of the prince that shall come, the Romans under Titus, the connection with Vespasian, the whole plan of the fourth kingdom, they will come and destroy the city and the sanctuary with an awful flood, desolations and war. They're all determined. An awful consummation. Desolation will be poured out, and the people of God will go through a horrendous judgment, at least the Jews in AD 70, the historic people of God who had the covenant in their history. So there's going to be tough times. The city's going to be rebuilt, but troublous times. Think after you get back to the Babylonian captivity. The Messiah is going to be cut off. That's going to be a tricky time. It's for redemption, but how's that going to go over? And then the whole desolation in verses 26 and 27 of AD 70, and it especially emphasizes that's determined, and that will be, and Daniel is hereby being told, that'll be the end actually of the Old Testament Israel as the favored people of God. And now the true Israel of God are Jews and Gentiles who believe in Jesus. And then there's the comfort for us to see that all this was sovereignly determined regarding Christ and his cross and his covenant, the whole chronology, and the first coming has taken place. And our final point here, that being the comfort, the real comfort of Daniel 9, what is not the comfort? Because how does dispensationalists sell this passage in terms of comfort? What's their comfort? Is taught to the people of God, Brian.
The rapture.
The comfort is that the great tribulation is coming. It's going to be absolutely awful, but you're not going to be there. Phew. Oh, that's wonderful. You're not going to be there. So there is a great tribulation, but you're going to be raptured out of it. Right? What else is the comfort that they say? Then, of course, there is no rapture as the dispensations teach, so it's a false comfort. What else would a dispensationalist pray? Let's say he's preaching in this passage, and his third point is, a bit like our seventh C, the comfort of it all. What else is he going to say in his peroration? Verse 24, there's something in verse 24 that he's going to say. And how do they interpret verse 24?
Is it to do with the Jews?
Yes. He's going to say verse 24, and the good news is that all these promises are going to be literally fulfilled to the Jews in a Jewish kingdom. And then these six things, oh no, they're not referring to the cross. They're referring to the golden age of the Messiah for the Jews. And everybody goes, that's wonderful, I'm really happy for the Jews. And we'll be gardeners and pulling the ploughs for them and so forth. So it's not quite as comforting even as they would have us believe. But still, it's nice to see somebody happy and be able to, you know, be happy for them being happy. And then as a sort of a crumb for the New Testament church, they say, and here we are, we're in the great parenthesis. Everyone here tonight, I want you to know your plan B. Your plan B. God has his great bride, the church, and you're sort of a concubine. You're sort of a fill-in, you know, until he can get the woman that he really wants, Israel. I mean, I'm putting it in stark terms, but it really is an awful theology. Terrible. And it's a false cover, because none of those things are even true. And that's not what the pastor is dealing with at all. Brian?
And they say, and the church is going to inherit heaven, although unfortunately you're not going to be able to be on the earth. That's for the Jews.
Yes, we get heaven and they get earth.
We get the bride of Christ and they get the wife of God.
Yes. And then of course how does the Trinity work if they get they're the wife of God and we're the bride of Christ? But surely the triune God operates through Christ, and it's one God, and not only one hope and one calling, Ephesians 4, and one baptism, but it's also one body. And the one body is, especially the book of Ephesians is saying, one body of Jews and Gentiles through the work of Christ. And this is the great mystery. And the mystery isn't that the Old Testament never said anything about the coming of Christ, or especially the Old Testament prophets didn't say anything the coming of Christ. The mystery is that Jews and Gentiles are on full equality. And the Old Testament wasn't as clear on that. That's the mystery, which is now being revealed. And we saw that with Galatians 3, verse 28. I mean, if the sermon wasn't already a bit long anyway, it could really have gone into that. Because if there's neither Jew nor Greek, and there's neither slave nor free, and there's neither male nor female, these are distinctions because certain of those groups were inferior according to Old Testament law. None of those things exist. That is, we're all equal. We're all fully equal. As Jews and Gentiles, we have no favorites. There's no Joseph in the family of Jacob who gets a coat of many colors and with the other 11 or the other one brother looking on kind of envious. Full equality. Yeah.
I'm just thinking, Brian, about the 24 elders in heaven. What are those 12 sons of Jacob doing up there?
Okay.
They're supposed to be on the earth.
The 24 elders in heaven, and they're in heaven, and then two 12s, 12 tribes, or 12 sons of Jacob, and then the 12 apostles, and they're both in heaven. So, yeah, what are they doing there? They're actually gate crashing. They're breaking into somebody else's party, and it's a sort of a wedding party too. Yes. Well, is everyone clear on Daniel 9, 24 through 27? Because this was our last class, and I hope it was certainly exhaustive, and I hope it wasn't exhausting,